It's a physical therapy day here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in with our PTs, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody, back with us. Jill is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And Jill, good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
And Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to see you as well.
Awesome to be here the week before Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yikes is right. We are going to start the day today by talking about muscle imbalance, what it is, how to prevent it, and how to treat it. But we'll take your general physical therapy questions as well as we move along, of course. So what aches and pains do you currently have? What are you doing about them? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. So let's talk, what is muscle imbalance, Jill?
Right. So when we talk about muscle imbalances, we're talking about muscles more than likely on opposite sides of a joint. So for example, if you think about your quadriceps, the big muscle in the front of your thigh, and your hamstrings, the muscles on the back of your thigh, and how if there's a weakness, more than likely in your hamstrings compared to your quadriceps, how it can impact your knee, to have knee pain, put you at risk for injury. So for example, in the athletic population many years ago, there was information that came out that really demonstrated that somebody who was very quadriceps dominant, in other words, their quads were really strong, their hamstrings relative to that not as strong, could put them at risk for a knee injury. So that's the kind of muscle imbalance we're talking about.
Now, it's not fatigue.
It's not necessarily fatigue, although it could be fatigue. It's either like overall strength, or it could be an endurance weakness as well. You could have a weakness in endurance in your quads versus your hams and still run into the same problem.
And you can have imbalances not just in strength, but in mobility.
Right.
So one of the things that we see commonly is tightness in your hip flexor muscles on the front side of your hip as compared to your gluteal muscles on the back side. And those people tend to show up with back pain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there's left to right muscle imbalance, as I understand it.
There's a little bit of
right to left, or is it?
Well, you can have muscle imbalances when you compare your right leg to your left leg, for example. And depending on what you do or the activity you do, that's concerning, but it's not as concerning as the agonist antagonist or the muscles on the front and the back of the joint. So if I just think about my left hip, for example, and you think about the stabilizers on the outside, we have the gluteus medius in the back, which everybody talks about, and then we have your tensor fascia lata in the front. And a lot of people have a tendency to recruit their tensor fascia lata, and they have a weak gluteus medius.
Mm.
So that muscle imbalance, even though those two muscles do part of the same thing, they also do something different. And that muscle imbalance can have negative consequences not only on your hip, but we know from weakness in your gluteus medius that actually impacts your knee. You can end up with some anterior knee pain or patellofemoral pain because of that.
You know, it's interesting because when I thought about this topic,
mm-hmm.
I didn't even think about the legs. I thought about the arms,
mm-hmm.
and it was just reminded, you know, because I really enjoy watching baseball, and
mm-hmm.
I played a little back in the day. The pitchers,
yes,
if you're a right-handed pitcher, your right arm is going to be bigger, more muscular than your left arm.
Right. So in any activity that is unilateral, that is one arm dominant, so a baseball pitcher is a classic example, a tennis player, even water polo, any sport where you're throwing with a single hand, you'll have typically more mobility in that shoulder, maybe more strength as well. But those are expected differences left to right due to dominance. The issues that cause problems are usually front to back.
And so is it a question of activity or inactivity that creates the problem?
Yes to both. It's a question of too much of the same activity, and then those muscles will get dormant and not doing something specific for those muscles. So, you know, the classic thing that we talk about a lot of times is walking or biking. Mm-hmm. You know, you use the same muscles the same way day in and day out. And so those muscles that you use, you know, can get stronger, be more flexible, whatever. And the muscles that you don't use for that activity kind of start to shut down. It's funny. I got a chuckle. So I thought about this over the weekend too, Larry. I was driving somewhere and I saw a woman walking backwards up a steep hill. Mm-hmm. And I thought, good for her.
Yeah.
So, you know, I knew exactly what she was doing. Other people might have thought, oh, that woman looks crazy. But mm-hmm. I thought, you know what? Good for her. She was out on her walk and I saw her turn 180 degrees and go up that hill backwards. Yeah. So that's a classic example of using your muscles differently.
Absolutely. I forgot what I was going to say.
Train left the station.
Yeah, the train did leave the station. So
you already said it's Monday.
I was going to ask, well, as long as you're talking about backwards and forwards, I tend to, when I go out for my morning, I don't do that mm-hmm. as much as I, occasionally mm-hmm. I'll do it for a few seconds mm-hmm. and then I'll.
Yeah, walking backwards, great. Walking sideways.
Yes.
Walking grapevine sideways. Oh, I know what I was going to say, because you were talking about glute medius and tensor fasciae latae. What tends to also happen is that people are unaware that they're not using these muscles correctly. So, for example, someone will come into the clinic with back pain or hip pain and will do some strength testing, and they will actually test pretty strong in these muscles when we sort of isolate them. But they don't use them in their activities right. because they've developed a motor program that for human movement, we always take the most efficient path.
Right.
And sometimes that includes minimizing the use of some muscles, which contributes to this ongoing imbalance. So a lot of times we work on not just strengthening those muscles, but teaching people how to use them during their functional activities, being many of them being absolutely unaware that they're using the wrong muscle. So a classic is I usually have people start doing a simple standing hip abduction exercise. That is stand, lift your leg to the side. And I will tell you that 70% of the people I see, and this is just like anecdotal off the top of my head, will lean to the side mm-hmm. as they lift their leg because it's easier to get their leg up by leaning in the opposite direction than actually using their glute muscles to do the lifting.
Right. And so when we identify things like that, maybe they have that strength, but as Lori alluded to, they don't know how to use it. Then it's all about neuromuscular reeducation and teaching them how to use it. And it may be the use of tactile cueing or bands or mirrors so they can see mm-hmm. the movement pattern. And then the patient comes back and says, that was really hard. Mm-hmm. And I say, what do you mean? And they say, I had to really think about that. Like I had to be in a quiet room and really focus on that because as Lori alluded to, you're trying to change their motor program. And so we're trying to make a new motor program automatic. And before you can get there, you really have to think about it. It's very cognitive mm-hmm. to begin.
Well, Bill in Barnes has something that may relate exactly to this, so let's go there. Bill, thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. I was about to switch channels because I thought I'm going to be scolded by Larry again for not exercising.
Never.
But then I listened to what you were talking about, and here's my question. I've got been prescribed or diagnosed as peripheral neuropathy, mostly in my left leg, but also some in my fingers and arms. I had chemotherapy decades ago, and there's a little of that is residual from that. Mm-hmm. But my left leg, when I walk, which I do about 4 or 5 miles a day in 2 walks, doesn't come up quite as far. I know this in the woods that I trip on roots more with my left foot than my right foot. I have some episodic pain in my left knee when I'm climbing stairs and in my left hip if I'm sitting in a car for any length of time where my left leg is stretched out in front of me and the hip is rotated at the outside. Is that imbalance? And is there any... not to make the full diagnosis here, but what should I tell my doctor? Because he kind of says peripheral neuropathy, there's not much he can do about it.
Yes and no. So I agree with the fact that there's not a lot we can do about the peripheral neuropathy, but the joints proximal to it, that hip, that knee, those core muscles could definitely be addressed. So not in your maybe lower way down distal, but more proximally, yeah. I definitely think so.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, you're catching your foot on things.
Yes.
Big red flag.
You need a walking pole or something.
Yeah. Well, walking poles, or you need somebody to train you, as Jill said, going through this cognitive process. I don't know if you have the strength in your ankle dorsiflexors to pull your foot up when you walk. So rolling the tape back, I don't know how cognitive this is and how much this is actually muscular weakness or lack of sensation. So I would say to your doctor, I need a referral to physical therapy so somebody can sort this out. So it is possible to train these things within the guardrails of what strength and sensation you have in that left leg. But given that this started with your foot or distal extremities, and now you have knee issues and hip issues, I assure you this will continue to march up the kinetic chain to your back if you don't intervene now. So seeing a physical therapist who can sort through how much of this is sensation, how much of this is mechanical, how much of this is trainable is a really important first step, especially for someone who walks in the woods.
So give that information to your doctor.
Absolutely.
And get yourself into a physical therapist.
Right. We want to keep him. We want to keep Bill active.
Right. Because we don't want to scold him for not being active. Right.
Or scold him for falling.
Or scold him for falling. Exactly.
And Bill and Barnes is have property with some friends up there, so I know Barnes, Wisconsin, very well.
Okay.
Nice.
Bill, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Margaret in Wausau, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, good morning. I have an accessibility question. My niece, who lives in Madison, actually, was starting to have knee problems. So she went to the therapist, and the bill was $500. Well, they do have insurance. However, each of their, it's her husband and my niece and their son, each deductible is $4,000. So I think she kind of like thought, oh, I just can't do this. And my question for you is, would you recommend or what kind of alternative kind of advice, like a website or something? Do you have any ideas on that that one could get? Because sometimes these going to a therapist, even if you have insurance, just is not doable.
Right. So that's a great question. So it would be in your niece's best interest when she sees a physical therapist to explain that there's no deductible that has been met and I'd like as many things to do as I can do independently on my own, including how to progress a few exercises. So if she didn't do that with her first visit, she may not have been unaware of this cost. At a follow-up visit, I would say, look, I need to be as independent as possible on this. What can you provide me? And that would be a really good place to start. And then that physical therapist may be able to recommend websites or other things that she could do that's a little bit more low cost. So
and specific to her.
Exactly. Right. Specific to her diagnosis, her condition, things like that.
So I will see people who have barriers to payment for various medical services. And so usually they would tell me up front. So I will generally give them, spend a lot more time on education.
Yes.
Like, this is where we're starting. This is what I think. This is where I think you should go. This is how you progress. These are the red flags to watch out for. And then, you know, depending upon where she is and what her situation is, she might find a personal trainer at a gym if she belongs to a gym, or even personal trainers that work independently to work with you and make sure that you're doing your exercises correctly. And then, like, for those of us in the UW system, we have ways to communicate with our patients for free. So I will tell patients, this is what I think you need to go do. This is how you progress. If you run into trouble, send me a MyChart message, mm-hmm. and we can communicate via MyChart, and I can give you some guidance that way. So that may or may not be available to Margaret's niece
right.
as well. So yeah. just trying to find those alternative pathways, it's really difficult in the current third-party payer environment.
Right.
Absolutely.
But communicate those up front, because mm-hmm. most PTs will have some sort of strategy to work with you.
Right. There Great you question.
Go. Yeah, thank you, Margaret. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And we have open lines to get you on pretty quickly as we talk with our physical therapist, Lori Tyne Brody, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at physical therapy on the program today, we've started by talking a little about muscle imbalance, but we're taking other questions as well as we join in. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Email question is, hiking an uneven surface or uneven surfaces generally better than walking on smooth pavement for imbalance issues?
Anytime you're on an uneven surface, that's going to challenge your balance. It's going to work your muscles differently than if you're walking on a straight, forward, predictable surface. So as long as you're safe from a balance perspective, walking on an uneven surface, and I'm thinking of like Devil's Lake, mm-hmm. walking on the stones or mm-hmm. whatever, absolutely. The other thing to think about with that kind of surface, if you're somebody who has, for example, arthritis in your knee, doing a long hike on that uneven surface creates a lot of various rotational torques at your knee, and it can flare up mm-hmm. an underlying condition. So it's not an all or none question. It's a matter, well, like all things that we say in medicine, is it depends. It depends. Mm-hmm. So it's a dosage thing. So if you have a relatively healthy knee and you want to work more on uneven work and balance and so on, great thing. If you have a little bit of underlying arthritis, it's still a good thing to do, but I would start very slowly.
Right. That arthritis doesn't like to be surprised.
It does not like, that's a great way to put it.
Thank yeah. you. Mm-hmm. But what would be good for that hiking, if your knees, if your joints in and of themselves are healthy, that also helps stimulate bone. Mm-hmm. So doing the same level surface walking over a while, your bone's going to say, oh, this isn't that stimulating for me. I'm not going to lay down more bone. But to use that differently, the bone will say, oh, this is new and exciting, and I'm going to lay down a little bit more bone. So from a bone mineral density perspective, it may be advantageous depending on what level you're starting at.
So bones like to be surprised,
bones
but
like
joints
be...
don't.
Correct.
Okay. Maybe we should like put that, you know, as a banner across
Correct.
The bottom of the
Correct.
Website.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it.
Yeah.
Let's go to Mary in Green Bay next. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I'm getting a little excited about this muscle imbalance.
I never thought I'd ever hear anyone say that.
Besides you and me.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've been trying to troubleshoot an issue, and I'm in physical therapy, and we started out because I'd be driving for maybe an hour and a half, and I'd get this pain that would run down the side of my leg. So tried to take care of that and thought we'd be working the piriformis. But when I was in yoga, I was sitting, you know, cross-legged, and I'm finding that I can recreate that pain or discomfort in the front of my leg. And it's to the point where when I would be sitting for a while and I would stand up, that pain would come through the leg to the point where it's like, oh, man, is my leg going to give out on me? But it's not to that extent, but that thought comes into my mind. And I, you know, as a cyclist, and I, you know, kind of did some of the same hard stuff over and over again. So I'm just wondering, maybe I should be talking to my therapist about muscle imbalance rather than, I don't know, we stopped working the piriformis, and now he just has me doing a leg raise you know, engaging that knee and engaging that quad and raising it. But all that does is just seem to redirect or remind me of the discomfort in that muscle. But maybe that's what physical therapy is about. I don't know.
So you're having pain in the front of your hip? Is that what I'm hearing? Or in your groin?
It's kind of in the front, you know, in that muscle is the best I can identify it. And I feel bad for my physical therapist because 1 week I'll come in and I think, oh, it's over on this side. But what I'm finding is I cannot sit cross-legged anymore, like in yoga, without that really making me take that leg out and adjust it. And then when I sit for a little bit and stand up, it seems to be that same pain.
Does it feel like it's deep in your joint, Mary?
I mean, I can push into that quad muscle, or I mean, I can, it does feel more deep than when I'm, than surface, I think.
So are you like midway down your thigh in your quad or up high at your hip in your quad?
Yeah, see, I'm just sitting down now to recreate this. It's kind of in the, it's like runs all the way up. Is that, I mean, so when I try to push up off the floor, it kind of runs the front of it and up. So, go ahead.
It's feeling primary hip joint
to me. It sounds hippish to me as well, because you're talking about sitting for 90 minutes in a car with, you know, the joint kind of compressed.
Right.
And then now you're talking about sitting.
Especially compressed in front.
Exactly.
And now you've twisted, you've externally rotated, torqued it. You know, maybe a little impingement, femoral acetabular impingement that's creating.
It very well could be.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I wonder about some traction.
I was thinking about long axis hip distraction.
Yep, that's what I was thinking too.
What's that?
And a little bit of anterior hip mobilization.
Correct.
Yeah, you
What's
go.
What's
that? So long axis hip distraction would be where, you know, basically you think about it, you're up all day and your hips are loaded and compressed all day long, and you want to just unload that hip. So a physical therapist can do it manually. You lay on your back and they kind of tug on your hip in a certain, or on your leg in a certain position. But Lori literally just picked up a picture
of it.
How do you have that with you today?
Because it was on my desk.
Okay.
I give this handout to patients of how to do self long axis distraction, but I spilled coffee on it. So I decided I couldn't give it to a patient. I'd bring it for scrap paper today.
So you can use a leg press type machine where, Mary, you would put your unaffected hip on the plate, the platform per se, and then your affected hip would be off to the side, and you would use a heavy TheraBand and kind of anchor or tie that affected hip down, and then you try and push away, and that would unload your hip.
Yeah.
Your physical therapist could show you how to do that.
Right.
But
we have a picture in our book. That's where the picture's from.
Oh.
So if your physical therapist has my textbook, there's a picture in there that you can do at home with a band.
So the question
And that
goes,
was Lori, by the
that
way.
That was Lori.
Yeah, it's Lori, yeah.
So the question goes back to, you know, is it a muscle imbalance or is it a muscle imbalance due to some joint restrictions? Mm-hmm. So I feel like Mary needs to have maybe a bit deeper dive into her hip and looking more at mobility of her hip before we go down the path of muscle strengthening. She might need more mobility to her hip and then do some strengthening.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm going with it. So see what your PT thinks of that, Mary.
Mary, does
and
that
let
help?
Us know.
Oh, yeah, I just couldn't write fast enough.
Well, you can listen again tonight.
What is it, an hour, Jeff, after the show's over? By 2 o'clock today, the show will be up. And you can listen back to yourself again at about a half hour into the show.
Yeah, you can hear yourself on the radio.
Not bad, but I want the information.
I feel that same way, Mary.
Thanks very much, Mary, and good luck with that. Appreciate it. And by the way, just go to WPR.org/Larry, and you can go to today's program, and you can listen at 2 o'clock or after to the Today Show. There you go. You can join in, too. The number to call. We'll get you on pretty quickly if you have a question for us. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Tim and Lady Smith called, couldn't stay with us, but asked if they're, going back to the MyChart business, is there a charge for MyChart portal messaging, like Jill and Lori described, to keep down costs for patients?
Well, at this time, for physical therapists, no, there's no charge. So I don't know if at some point down the road people are talking about, you know, the work that the medical staff has to do to respond to medical questions, but at this point, at least in the UW Epic system, there's no charge for communicating with your physical therapist that way.
Right. And I know I'm in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health, which is a very, very large department, as you can imagine. And I've heard the physicians discuss how long it takes them to go through their in-basket in MyChart at night, and physicians are spending 2 to 3 hours at night trying to get to these, to answer these queries, because people don't have access to healthcare and things like that, and trying to figure out a way where there's some sort of reimbursement for the physician's time, not necessarily coming from the patient, but somehow having those extra work hours outside of work hours somehow being compensated because they do spend so much time answering emails. Lori, I have no idea how many hours outside of work you do in a week to answer queries.
I usually try to answer them. We have some administrative time during the day, so I try to answer those during the day as best I can.
Got it.
We're supposed to get back to our patients within 24 hours. So I know the physicians, like when we, or like when my kids message physicians, it goes to a nurse.
Correct.
Who triages that first. Right. But for us, it goes to our front desk, and our front desk sends it on to us.
Got it.
I'm always surprised at how quickly they respond anytime I've ever had to send a message in through my chart.
Right.
It's pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. It's often just hours. I've already heard back. So.
Yeah, that's the standard. We're supposed to get back. So they're trying hard, at least here at UW, to get back to people in a timely manner.
Steve in Ironwood, Michigan has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've got, I think you talked about it a few weeks ago, but I was driving and didn't get it. Between my knee from a foot to 2 feet up in the front of my thigh, it's like pins and needles, numbness. Sometimes sitting up, a sharp pain will shoot through there. It's nerves. When you touch it with your fingers, like touching a sunburn, you know.
Is that just one side?
Yes.
Yeah. So usually that's a lateral femoral cutaneous nerve impingement. Usually happens when you sit and there's a nerve that goes to the front of your thigh that can get compressed. And usually when you stand up, it feels better. Is that the case?
It feels better, but still, when standing, when I touch it, it's still like touching like a sunburn area, you know, that type of discomfort. Yeah. Not pain exactly.
Do you have weakness with it, Steve?
No.
Okay.
No.
So then
I'm under physical therapy now for balance. Is there something they can do at the physical therapy place for that?
Yeah, have them take a look at it and see if they can reproduce it there, and that way they should be able to verify that diagnosis.
And there's a neuromobilization you can do. So sometimes this nerve just kind of gets entrapped in some muscles, kind of as it comes out the side of your hip. So your physical therapist could teach you how to do a little bit of neuromobilization to make sure you get that moving. Mm-hmm. Lori had this from when you had that backpack frame. You forgot.
Yeah. Yes, I forgot.
So this can come from having a load on your hips. So wearing a heavy tool belt, a work belt. Lori wore an ill-fitting backpack frame and went hiking, and it sat funny on her hip, and she ended up with this.
Yeah, I forgot about that. You have an amazing memory.
Good memory there.
She does.
Well, as Steve was talking, I realized I had not taken my billfold out of my back pocket.
Oh, there you go.
And because that creates some pains for me,
too. For sure.
Oh, that's
absolutely
a classic for piriformis and sciatica.
Yes. Yeah. That and bucket seats and cars.
Oh,
especially the combination of those two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Steve, does that help?
Yeah, I broke an arm about 2 weeks ago, and I told the orthopedic guy about it. He said, it's in the spine, which I guess you're saying the same thing.
Well, it could be, although lateral femoral cutaneous nerve is sensory only. There's no muscle weakness associated with it. That's why I asked about that, Steve. If it is coming from your spine and it's a nerve root, you may or may not have some muscle weakness with it. So I think starting, this would be your lowest hanging fruit, starting with the lateral femoral cutaneous nerve. And if it's not that, then maybe looking the next level up and looking at your back.
All right. Good luck, Steve. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Kim in Eau Claire. Kim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. Morning, ladies. Morning, guys. So I was wondering about injections to grow cartilage. Have they gotten any further with that? Down the road, I'm bone on bone on both knees. I've talked to you ladies about this before. Mm. I've dropped 69 pounds.
Wow. That's amazing. Good for you.
Yeah, thanks. Been a over a year.
Good
know,
for
process,
you.
But,
so
yeah,
are you? So
that really helped.
Okay, great. So that's a really good indication that offloading your joints or taking load off of your joints is helpful. Kim, are we talking about your knees here? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, both knees.
Both knees.
Yeah,
okay.
I had meniscal surgeries, 50 on one, and had two on the other, and sports related.
Okay. So you have some meniscal damage, less meniscus than we'd like. So we lost some of that cushioning. But to combat that, you've lost 70 pounds. We're just going to round up, Kim, to 70. You've lost 70 pounds, which is amazing. So now we know that offloading that joint helps. What about knee strengthening? I mean, we can talk about injections, but before we even talk about that, you know, another way to offload the joint, Lori, would be to really get good and strong.
Right, right. To increase the strength in your quadriceps, they can absorb up to 60% of your body weight with every step you take if you're using them efficiently. We also like to put people in your situation in a pool to do strengthening there while offloading the joint. So I wouldn't go into any kind of injection without an ongoing physical therapy program at the same time. So, you know, the issues about, you know, regrowing cartilage, you know, stem cells, all that, it's still a bit of hit and miss, I would say. So we have better success with things like Synvisc for increasing some of the lubrication, so to speak, in the joint rather than growing cartilage.
I can't remember, Kim. Did you have Synvisc injections or hyaluronic acid injections? Have you tried that?
No. I've talked to you guys. Unfortunately, my doctor went straight to steroids, and you guys went, oh, no.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure
but
we
that's
did.
What he did. But I haven't had an injection now. I did have surgery on my right knee a little over a year and whatever ago. It's come back fine. I did have an accident this summer that messed up my left knee again, but never mind.
So, you know, seeing if you're a candidate for Synvisc injections would make sense. You know, perhaps your physician went directly to cortisone because you weren't a candidate
for it.
So not everybody is a candidate for Synvisc. Larry was. He's had great success with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it isn't for everybody. Right. So having that conversation with your physician and finding out why cortisone was the first line and just making sure you're in PT and getting as strong as you can and making sure whatever your accident was this summer, if there's any way to prevent additional accidents via balance training, strength training, and so on, I think would be in your best interest for the long-term health of your knee.
There you go, Kim. Good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Lori in Weston, we'll go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
Great. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, so I have been recently having a problem where my right hip flexor will just randomly, I'll get like a shooting pain and my leg just wants to collapse. Sometimes it happens if I'm going downstairs or sometimes if I'm just walking, it'll just wants to collapse. And I am in reasonably good shape. I bike regularly and work out. But this is something that just started happening over the last couple of months, and I'm not sure if I should, what my next course of action should be.
Sure. So is it pain that makes you collapse? Like, do you get a shooting pain and then you feel like your muscle doesn't work and you want to collapse? Or is there no pain with it when this happens, Lori?
No, there's definitely pain.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's probably a muscle inhibition from the pain. So what we know happens with muscles is when there is some sort of shooting pain, or if there's a small amount of swelling around a joint, that can easily cause what we call muscle shutdown. So I hear this muscle's probably shutting down because of a reaction to the pain. The question is, why are you having pain in the first place? So seeing a physical therapist is going to be the smart way to go.
Right, right. Seeing if it's coming from your hip, if you have a little hip impingement and you're hitting something just right,
like a bursa,
in your hip.
Like the,
or if she's got a little, again, we're back to FAI, a little femoral acetabular impingement.
Right.
And you're catching it just right when you step a certain way. Does it happen when you exercise?
Certain types of exercise, like if I go to a boxing class, sometimes I'll land at it and it'll speak to me loudly.
Something like that. Absolutely. If you said it was bothering you, for example, when biking, I'd be a little more surprised about that.
Right.
But anytime you're doing something where you're loading or especially landing on
explosive.
That leg. Then I would expect it more. So I'd see a physical therapist and have them take a look at that hip as the primary source of your issue here. Mm-hmm.
Good luck, Lori. Thank you for calling. Sandra in Whitewater. We'll go to you now. Hi, Sandra.
Hello. I think I already know the answer to my question before I ask it.
Oh, good. Excellent. I love that.
But now I think I'll ask the question anyway. So I've struggled with SI joint dysfunction for years and years and years. And the only thing that's helped is an exercise program that I got on actually years ago from UW Health. In the last 3 years in particular, it's been pretty under control. The therapist that was helping me with a different issue, I asked at the end of our session if he could do a check of muscle imbalance because I knew that it was not quite right yet. And the last time anyone had checked for that was 2011, so it's been a while. And my therapist at that time said the hip external rotator was very weak. So my therapist decided to start with a quick mobility check. I think that's what you call it. You know, he raised one leg and then the other. And he kept asking me, is this okay? Yep. And then when I walked out of his office and on my way to the car, I noticed the SI joint pain was back. And then when I went to sit to drive home, I had trouble sitting. And it's been kind of like that now for almost a month. So I had given up my exercise program because it hurt, but now that giving it up really hasn't helped. I think I need, and this is where I think I already know the answer to the question, I think I need to inch my way back into that exercise program that helped in the first place, and then when I get this under control, really go back again for a muscle imbalance test. But my question is, the fact that this happened so easily, he's shocked. I'm shocked. It was nothing extreme that he did.
Right.
So does that give you any clues to what the problem could be?
I'm wondering if you're hypermobile.
Well, yeah. Either that or if, you know, we always know that a stiff hip goes with a hypermobile SI and vice versa. So it could be a relative, not muscle imbalance, but mobility imbalance here, where if Sandra's really tight in her hip joint, she's overusing her SIJ. So in reality, we need to treat the hip.
Right.
And some of the mobility things may have pushed the load into her SIJ when she was being assessed.
Right.
That's my first thought. But hypermobility somewhere.
That's it. Yeah, hypermobility somewhere. So the question is whether or not you can successfully get back to where you were by reinstituting your exercise program that you did before. So I don't know if your previous exercise program was designed to get you out of a problem with your SI joint, or if it was designed to maintain your SI joint stability where it was after you got it situated. So I can't answer the question of whether or not you should start it. The easiest thing to do is to restart it at a low level and see if it improves your symptoms. If not, you need to go back and have your SI joint and your hip assessed. So I don't know if she's now out, if she's got an upslip or a downslip or something that needs to be corrected
right
before it can be stabilized with the exercise program.
So yeah. I would start with the exercise program mm-hmm. and make an appointment, because I think we've already identified another condition mm-hmm. that could be the contributing factor to her SI joint, and that is this hip
right
potential impaired mobility. So
right
no matter what, that needs to be addressed. It's a matter of how okay you add that into the current rehabilitation program, and do you trade exercises, things like that. So I say start okay with a really low exercise, but get that appointment scheduled.
There
get
you go.
Scheduled.
I like that. It's a nice middle
hybrid
child
yes
response.
It's a sitting on the fence yes response. I'm not picking sides.
But it does seem to make a lot of sense
it
to
does
me.
It does.
For
yes
sure. Sandra,
yeah,
good luck with that. Thank you for calling. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum are physical therapists with us today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk travel with Lori Helke. She'll talk about her new book, Wisconsin Harbor Towns, and how to plan the ultimate Wisconsin road trip. And then travel agent Carrie Mulliken will be with us to help us plan a trip to warm weather destinations. So kind of looking forward to that, too. Right now, though, we're talking physical therapy issue. We've talked a bit about muscle imbalance, but taken other questions as well. Looking forward to hearing from you at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Jenny in Beldenville, Wisconsin, we turn to you now. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. This is a very interesting program. I had been doing water jogging 2 to 3 days of the week, and I thought maybe that was not the best. I need to mix that up. So I've been doing Nordic walking on hills and gravel roads. And I'm wondering, you know, what you think the benefits are of Nordic walking.
Oh,
the Nordic walking poles.
Yeah,
great.
Fabulous.
Perfect. Just make sure you walk more than one direction.
Right.
Like we said at the top of the show, some walking backwards, some sidestepping, some grapevine. Just do a variety of movements. Even if you're able to do a little bit of skipping, hopping, jumping.
I
love skipping.
Yeah.
So just that. And you know, how many adults, like how many of you out there remember how to skip?
Right.
So I ask my patients, you know, let's try to skip, and they look at me. They usually end up leaping or hopping, mm-hmm. and I'm like, a skip is a step hop. And the nice thing about starting with skipping is that you land directly underneath you. So it's not like a leap or a hop where you jump forward and have to land, which is a little harder. But in a skip, you step and then you hop, you know, directly vertically and come straight back down. So it's a great place to start a little bit of impact, and you can do it mm-hmm. just very gently.
Mm-hmm. Just be really careful if the gravel, make sure if you're doing this on the gravel that it's really stable gravel. Mm-hmm. It's not a loose gravel road.
Right.
But yeah, no, I think it's wonderful and to mix it up
yeah.
because the water jogging won't give you that bone mineral density benefit that all of this will.
Right, but it'll unweight all of your joints, which they love.
100%.
So it's a really nice combination
yep.
of both things.
Poles are nice, too, because you're swinging your arms. And
right,
great.
Right. I love walking poles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it very much. Peggy in Madison will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Peggy.
Hi there. Thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I went on a long drive last weekend, and, you know, about 6 or 7 hours in the car, probably didn't get out enough. And when I got out of the car, my leg, sort of from my hip down my right buttock to the upper thigh, really hurt. And I kind of thought, stretch it out a little, it'll go away. But it basically hurt overnight, and it still hurts. So I'm wondering, maybe what I can do about that, and if continuing to just walk and do normal exercise is good for it or bad for it.
So I would say that continuing to walk and move and stretch is a good thing.
And yeah.
Yeah. So absolutely. And, you know, why did it happen? Who knows? Well, I had a similar thing. Yeah. And Jill manipulated my SI joint and my low back and needled my piriformis and all that. So
you know it's sisterly love when you're willing to needle your other sister in the ARSE.
Right, exactly. So it, you know, this may work itself out with some stretching and so on. But if it's not, over the course of the next couple of weeks, right. you should get in and see somebody
right.
before it starts to reel out of control and you start limping and then you cause symptoms in a knee or a back or so on and so forth.
Right. I would say within 10 to 14 days, this should resolve itself. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't, it's time to see someone. And the other thing, Peggy, is if this car drive is something that you're going to do with some regularity, then it's definitely important to see a physical therapist and talk about making sure that your car is set up appropriately, that your rear view mirror is set up appropriately, your lumbar spine is set up, you know, appropriately, that you're sitting upright, and then also talk about taking frequent breaks.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, absolutely.
As I was thinking, as you were talking, I was thinking about my friend who has a problem with her foot. And mm-hmm. so she said, okay, I'm going to go in and see, you know, somebody. And they said, oh, yeah, we can get you right in February.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's an issue. So mm-hmm. sometimes we tell people to make an appointment and then if you don't need it, you can cancel.
Right.
Somebody will be happy to have that time.
Right. It's always easier to make an appointment than it is to find one and mm-hmm. cancel it than find one when you need one. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, mm-hmm,
all
for
right.
sure.
Just wanted to bring that up.
Yeah.
Thanks, Larry.
Access to healthcare is challenging. It's very challenging.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Gus in De Pere, your turn. Hi, Gus.
Yeah, hi. Before I ask my question, just a quick note. I called about a year ago with pain in my thigh and my buttocks when I was driving. And I was having physical therapy done at the time. And you girls said, it's your back. It's not your thigh. And I got a cortisone injection in my back, and boom, you were right on.
Oh, well played. Good job. Well, I'm glad you're feeling better. That's awesome.
Well, he must not
but
be
now
perfect.
He's got something else.
Oh, I know. Well, anyway, go ahead, Gus. Tell us what's up now.
All right. Any rate, that part's better. But this summer in July, I just knelt down, and I felt something behind my knee.
Mm. Oh,
and
yep.
It really hurt, and I went and see a doctor, orthopedic surgeon, and he said, "Nah, you don't need surgery," and didn't really know exactly, but they did an MRI, and it looks like a Baker's cyst.
Sure.
At birth. And so it was bad, and I got a cortisone injection there that helped. Then I went, and another guy, he drained some of this cyst.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it, he said, was so thick he couldn't get the goop out.
Oh, oh my,
and
lovely.
That helped. But my whole calf would just cramp and ache.
Yeah.
And now it's just behind the knee again, mm-hmm. just that area.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if physical therapy, massage, and that kind of thing might help. It's just not getting better.
Yes. So Gus, and when they did the MRI, did you have a meniscus tear? Do you know what?
I do.
You do?
Well, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah.
He's got
to have something going on
right.
back there to cause that
Baker cyst. Yeah.
So the reason you get a Baker cyst, which is kind of a bleb in your tire, for lack of better terms, and then a bunch of fluid escapes out there in the back of your knee, as you alluded to, Gus, and then it causes difficulties with range of motion pain, is because you have something going on within your joint intra-articularly. So you probably have some arthritic changes in there. Like we talked about earlier in the show, your knee doesn't like to be surprised. Arthritic joints don't like to be surprised. So maybe kneeling and loading that way was just enough to kind of tear a worn out portion of your
mm-hmm.
meniscus.
Oh.
Not every meniscal tear is surgical.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing a physical therapist to unload his knee, I'm thinking about like some really mm-hmm. nice seated distraction,
mm-hmm.
those kind of mobilizations to increase mobility,
yep.
kind of pump that fluid around, and then
right.
some good strengthening.
Right. And some yeah. pool. Getting
some
in a pool,
pool
to,
right.
to unload and
mm-hmm.
unweight and
great.
Exercise there. So yeah, that's kind of where I would go at this point. And you know, I would stay in touch with the surgeon, because if this continues to swell and you continue to get symptoms in the back of your knee, they may want to look at doing something else inside your knee.
There you go, Gus. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Talking physical therapy today with our guests from the University of Wisconsin, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on on Talk at WPR. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. We're talking physical therapy right now with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Lori's a physical therapist, athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill is a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW Madison. Great to have them with us. And callers online, so let's go to the phones. Celine in De Pere, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a couple of questions for your therapist. I've had knee repair surgery, knee replacement surgery for both knees, and in the process of healing up after the second knee replacement surgery, both of my kneecaps fractured.
Oh.
And it's kind of stopped my physical therapy on the left knee. They said, keep everything nice and straight. Don't bend, don't do steps. Solid month. So after that, I wanted to, they told me the scar tissue in between both of those fractured kneecaps heals strong, just as strong as bone.
It can.
And according to them, it's healed. Both kneecaps are healed. But there's still swelling on the outside of both of my knees.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been on the inside. I went to my chiropractor and had laser treatment done to help with the circulation and healing. And that's healed the inside of my knees from swelling, but the outside is still swollen. So I'm doing, per my doctor's information back to me, wearing compression, like knee cuffs and then compression socks. And I've also, 2 years ago, I rolled my ankle walking in the backyard. And so the right side of my foot swells on occasion.
So you've got a lot of persistent swelling, in other words.
So how did these kneecaps fracture? Just sort of idiopathic? Did they just fracture, or did you fall, or?
Nope, they just fractured. The right one, which I had replaced 2 years ago, all of a sudden was as swollen and sore as the left one that I had replaced this year.
So it sounds like just a lot of load through that patellofemoral joint and on the undersurface of her knee when they replace that, the undersurface of your kneecap when they do a total joint replacement. If, you know, that insult just made a tiny, tiny little line that was like a stress type thing and then became a full-blown non-displaced fracture.
Right.
So the inability for you to bend your knee for 4 weeks is so deleterious to your joint and so such a difficult thing because swelling just sits there and pools.
Right.
So you have no way to pump all that fluid out. So now you're kind of, for lack of better terms, behind the eight ball and trying to catch up with all this fluid that's sitting there and stagnant. So the compression garments will help, but will help more than anything is muscle movement and I would say getting in a pool because of the hydrostatic pressure.
Right, right. So exercising in a pool, working on your range of motion, working on strengthening, you can do all kinds of strengthening for that knee in a pool, and the hydrostatic pressure will, for all practical purposes, function like a compression sleeve. So it's a great place for you to do your exercises and work on your mobility.
Right.
Yeah.
This is especially with two knees. I mean, she's got so much going on here.
It's a it's going to be a really difficult road to recover from.
And especially with her ankle. So if she's had a history of an ankle sprain, she'll be much safer in a pool. You know, you're not going to risk an inversion ankle sprain or anything like that. And it will help with her swelling in her ankle as well.
Right, exactly.
Celine, there you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Christina in Glenwood City, your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. This is a question that I hadn't considered until today's program. I purchased a beautiful Native American walking stick that's made from a branch. And it's about my height, which is 5 feet, 1.5 inches. So what is the best way to use this so that I don't develop a muscle imbalance?
So you have it just on one side? Yeah, just have one stick.
A single walking stick.
Okay. So I would obviously use it on both sides.
Alternate.
Yeah, I would alternate sides, whether you did it for a certain amount of time or a certain number of steps that you count in your head or for, you know, a song or however you do your walking. I would absolutely switch from side to side. And then, as we mentioned earlier, we do some backwards walking. We do some sidestepping. Again, as long as you're in a place or walking someplace where it's safe to do that. But yeah, alternating the walking stick side to side would be the key to maintaining balance that direction. Jill's looking at me with a very funny expression on her face.
Is there a certain height you recommend for walking poles? Like, is it a certain percentage of your overall height, or is it your arm
Lori? It should be sort of your arm straight out. Yeah. So you shouldn't be holding it higher than shoulder height.
Right. So don't hold the top of this if it's the same height as you.
Exactly.
Good luck, Christina. Thank you for calling. Amy in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Amy.
Hi. I just had a question about what I believe to be an athletic injury. I have, at times, my knees can, on the back of my knees, it will bulge. And I did go to a knee specialist when I first noticed it, and he had me walk and kind of felt the knee and said, as long as it's not hurting, you're fine. And then over the years, like, at times it will bother me, maybe if I'm not wearing the best shoes or the heat of the summer or on my feet a lot. And another doctor told me they thought maybe they were both Baker's cysts. So... that's what I guess I'm curious is in what, if that is it, what you recommend.
So a Baker cyst is a bleb in your car tire. So it's like a little bleb in the capsule or the joint that holds all of your fluid, and it's a weakness in it. And so some fluid from your knee actually escapes out into that area on the back of your knee, as you talked about, Amy. And it's a sign that there's something else going on inside your knee. So you don't just get a Baker cyst unless there's something else going on, what we call intra-articularly. So either you have a little bit of arthritic changes there, maybe some tiny little meniscal tears, something along those lines, just general wear and tear. So the take-home message is getting in to see a physical therapist for your knees to get them assessed to make sure that you have adequate mobility, that you don't have a muscle imbalance, that you have good strength in the front and the back of your knee would be very appropriate. And then the first thing that comes to mind for me from like an exercise perspective is knees love to be bathed in their articular cartilage. So I always think about either recumbent or upright biking as a really great activity for people who have some arthritic changes in their knees.
Right. So if you're consistently doing the same kind of exercise over and over, you might want to, it'd be good to see a physical therapist who could give you some advice about what kinds of activities to do, what kind of shoes to wear. You mentioned that you noticed a pattern with your shoe wear. And shoes that lack sufficient shock absorption will pass that load onto your knee. Also, as Jill mentioned, the muscle imbalances can overload your knee, and that is if you're not using your quadriceps and your gluteal muscles effectively when you take a step, then you can pass that load onto the joint surfaces of your knee rather than your muscles doing their job. So again, seeing a physical therapist for a couple of visits to sort through some of these potential causes of your swelling would be really useful in giving you a path forward.
Amy, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Kelly emailed to say their 59-year-old brother was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré syndrome in August, developed pneumonia, received a tracheotomy. Mm-hmm. About 2 weeks ago, Kelly's brother finally got rid of his tracheotomy and feeding tube and was transferred to a long-term care facility.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly's brother started getting feeling back in his hands and was able to move them, but most recently the feeling in his right hand has worsened. Mm. Wondering how common this is, and can you speak to long-term recovery with this condition?
Well, GBS, Guillain-Barré syndrome, is fortunately rare, and it is an idiopathic, unknown etiology where there is progressive neurological weakness throughout all the extremities, to the point that many people do have to be intubated because they can no longer breathe on their own. So you see people kind of spiral downhill relatively quickly. They are hospitalized. They're typically in ICU. As you can imagine, there's a lot of things that go with that, including the pneumonia that Kelly mentioned in her 59-year-old brother. Then at some point, it kind of turns its direction and people start slowly getting better and they get extubated, as Kelly talked about, and then they can get moved to a long-term rehabilitation facility to regain their strength, their mobility, neuromuscular control. So why her brother is having kind of a new episode of weakness in that hand, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure why he's seen a reversal in that. It could just be the ebb and flow of the recovery process.
Sure.
But people do tend to slowly recover over time and regain a lot of their strength back. The things that are least likely to recover, or the things that tend to be residual, tend to be more distal, and that is hands, calf muscles, feet, and things like that. But a lot of people make a very good recovery after this. It's just long and slow.
Right.
Amy in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Amy?
We talked about Amy, about her Baker cyst.
We did Amy already. Let's go to Kay in Grand Chute, who called but couldn't stay with us. Kay asked if dancing is a good activity to address imbalance issues. Kay remembers doing the twist as a teenager, so she's up there a little bit if she was doing the twist as a teenager. But dancing certainly is a great exercise and I think good for mobility.
It's wonderful. It gets all those directions we talked about, forward, backward, side to side, slow, fast, all of those things. In fact, there's a physical therapist here in town who teaches ballroom basics for balance, and it's a dance class that focuses primarily on making sure that your balance is safe. So the balance component also comes through with dance as well. Yeah. So yes, dance is fantastic.
Yeah, we love those odd movements for bone density. So dancing is great. Put on some music that you love and go crazy in your living room.
Exactly.
Dee emailed to ask two questions. First, Hyaluronic acid. Yes. I don't know why I have trouble with that. Would it help a male age 72 with a spur on the outer edge of his knee to decrease pain and an occasional giving out of the knee? And there's a second one.
It might.
Yeah.
So he really needs to see, needs to see their physician, because there's a certain level of arthritis that is helped with a hyaluronic acid injection, and then others that are not. So it requires, the injection's going to require a visit to a physician. So a physician needs to look at the imaging of the knee and make that call.
Right.
Let's see.
Second question.
Would a marching on grass turf help bone density, but with less wear on the knee? So if you're working around on grass turf.
So we're going to do the age-old, it depends. So it all depends on where your bone density is to start. So if you're doing something higher level, like dancing or playing soccer, marching on turf isn't going to cut it. It's not going to cut the cheese, because you're already doing a higher level activity. If you're doing nothing, could it help? Sure. Would it be better than a hard surface? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So as always, it depends. It depends upon this, your starting level
right.
and how active you are now. So if you're inactive, something's going to be better than nothing. If you're already pretty active and doing some other things that are loading your bones, doing something on a grass turf is going to be a step back.
Right.
And that's kind of what Jill's saying here. If I could interpret for you.
Thank you. Appreciate your help.
Tim in Chippewa Falls emailed to say, Tim feels pain in his right or in his left rhomboid muscle by the shoulder blade when Tim puts his feet up. The chiropractor says it's the fascia that's causing it and needs to be stretched. Do you think that's what it is? Is it like bursitis? Is there a way to treat it? So the
fascia
feels pain
yeah.
in the left rhomboid muscle.
So interestingly, there is a huge fascia point at T4.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about how all of this connective tissue, the Saran wrap around all of our muscles, there's a huge area where it kind of all connects and comes together at T4
mm-hmm.
and then again at L4. So is that plausible?
Sure. It is plausible.
But I think of things in the rhomboid area as more like cloward signs coming from your cervical spine, as if you're in cervical extension or something like that, mm-hmm. causing that referred pain.
So the question is,
when he puts his feet up does he go into cervical extension?
Does he change the position of his neck?
Exactly.
Yeah, good point.
Exactly.
So the question would be, so you put your leg up like you usually do, and then you nod your head
yes.
up and down and see if it changes the symptoms in your rhomboid.
Hmm.
Right.
Right.
All right. Carrie emailed to say, sometimes uncomfortable with their physical therapist because the therapist acts like a drill sergeant. Carrie said they have anxiety as well as neck pain and dizziness issues. They understand a lot of people don't take care of themselves, but it doesn't help when the physical therapist makes you feel awful about yourself.
Oh, dear.
That's
not okay.
Mm-hmm. No.
That is not okay at all. You know, as a physical therapist, you need to meet every single patient where they are physically, emotionally, mm-hmm. cognitively, and take them to the next level. So I'm sorry that Carrie's experiencing this.
Yeah.
You know, I would find another therapist.
Absolutely.
There's no reason you have to stay with that person. And I would say anecdotally, it's probably precluding you from your recovery.
Right, exactly. Well, and you know, it's like any medical professional, you need to have somebody that matches right. your style. So I will sometimes, like I co-treat with physical therapists all the time. And occasionally a patient will say, I'm not connecting. I feel like that person is not hearing me. Is there somebody who would be better suited? And so if I know that patient, which typically I would, I can sort of match their personality and their communication style with somebody else that I know is similar
to
that or is positively responds to that type of style. So it doesn't do any good to see a healthcare provider that you are not able to connect with and not able to communicate with.
Right.
So oftentimes we hear people who have not followed through or not gone to a healthcare professional when they should because they feel like their provider doesn't hear them.
Right.
Mm. And so super important to find someone that hears you so that you can be proactive in your healthcare.
Absolutely.
Back to dance for just a second before I go on to the next question. I was just reminded that we talked to the Ballroom for Basics founder on the show.
Oh.
It was September 5th.
Susan Fricken.
Susan mm-hmm. Fricken.
Mm-hmm.
That was September 5th on the show. So you can go back to talk at WPR.org/Larry, and you will find that. Or go to the app, go to our WPR app, which is pretty easy to do. And listen to it.
That's
it
great.
September 5th.
Lots of good information there. You might be a candidate.
Rebecca in Baraboo emailed to ask if a physical therapist can help a person with bad knees or hips get back to running. Rebecca used to run half marathons. Then in 2020, had a torn labrum in the right hip, missed running, and now has gained about 15 pounds
yeah.
since stopping running. And the goal would be to be able to do a 10K at most, or is it better to accept the fate and just walk instead?
So I really, as a general rule, have a really hard time telling people they can never do something. It's all about how you dose it. So for Rebecca, could we get her trained for a 10K? Absolutely. We would do enough running so her body's used to the running, but we would do a ton of cross training and making sure that she has a really good cardiovascular base by doing things that aren't going to bother her knees or hips. So she can swim, she can bike, she can do all those other things and just do enough running so she can get through that 10K. And is she going to be sore the next day? Sure. But it'll be worth it? Sure.
So, yeah. So our soccer players who have torn labrums and have had labrum surgery, they run miles in the course of a soccer match.
Oh, yeah. About 10.
So, yeah.
If you're
a
midi, you run about 10 miles a game.
Right. Right. Exactly. So it is possible to get back. You just want to make sure that you're strong enough. You have more weight on that now. So you may need to start with some other activities, a walk, jog. I would work with a personal trainer to have somebody dose you through that return to running program. You could obviously also see a physical therapist depending upon your health status.
Yeah.
I would see a PT just to make sure that she doesn't have any muscle imbalances, get those corrected, and then kind of ease into a personal trainer for that walk, jog, return to sport type program.
Yeah.
Catherine is 31 years old, has a chronic shoulder pain, which is worsening, suspects this issue is caused in part by sleeping on the side. Has noticed in the past 6 months that driving has also exacerbated the symptoms. Catherine has a 45-minute commute to the job as a delivery driver. After a long day, notices that shoulders, elbows, and trapezoid muscles become very sore, especially on the left side.
So she is a delivery driver?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay. Yeah. So I'm thinking about the vibration in that truck. I'm thinking about how, if she's driving one of those big trucks, how does it
Does she fit
the truck?
Right.
You know what I mean? They're reaching and
they're
doing all this
stuff. Right. But why the left side?
I don't know.
Why just one side and not the other? Unless she's a... Of course, the mail drivers are go out the right side, the U.S. Postal Office people. Mm-hmm. So she should see a physical therapist and sort this out. Because there's, if it was both sides, then you might think it was the vibration of the truck and the steering wheel. I'm steering for those of you who can't see the radio. That it might that it would be bilateral, be on both sides. So why is she having symptoms on one side? My age-old question. So seeing somebody to sort out why it is she's having symptoms on one side, and maybe sleeping on the left side sets her up for that, but there are things to help with this. So yes, there are things that can help with this. And since it's your job, get in and see somebody.
Yep.
And with that, we are out of time. I want to thank you both very much. I'm sorry we didn't get to all the emails. We should have started on those a little earlier, but well.
There's
next
always
month.
Next
There's
month.
Always next
There's
month,
always
Larry.
Next month. Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. At the UW-Madison. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back in a month, and we'll do it all over again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at dealing with seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. If you find yourself feeling depressed by the onset of the winter's long nights, you are definitely not alone. It's estimated that more than 13 million adults in the U.S. suffer from what's known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and our guest is Dr. Norman Rosenthal. He's a psychiatrist, researcher, and author. He first discovered and defined SAD 40 years ago. His work has been featured on Good Morning America, The Today Show, and more. He's written over 300 scholarly articles, authored and co-authored 11 books, and his latest book is titled Defeating SAD, A Guide to Health and Happiness Through All the Season.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. How do shorter days affect you in any way? What are you doing to find or defeat the winter blues? Or maybe what do you like about the longer nights? Want to hear from you? Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Norman Rosenthal, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Let's start at the beginning. You're credited with describing and naming seasonal affective disorder back in 1984. Can you tell us about the study or studies that led to it?
Sure. You know, I was lucky because coming from South Africa, where it was very sunny, I really noticed changes in myself as the days get short and dark. And then in the springtime, I would say to myself, well, what was that all about? Why were you fussing? You're fine, you know? And it would happen each year for 3 years. I was doing my residency up in New York City. And then I came down to the National Institute of Mental Health, where I was looking for a research project, when I came across someone who had the same problem but much worse than me. And I thought, wow, what if it's the light?
Yeah.
And so, you know, put an article in a newspaper and thousands of people recognized the symptoms in themselves and hadn't previously been diagnosed, recognized, pulled together. And that's what I did. I pulled the symptoms together, and with my colleagues there, we took people from the summer through the winter who had complained of this problem and saw bit by bit they developed the symptoms that they had described. And so we tested them with the lights, bright light exposure, and sure enough, it turned out to have a potent effect. So that was the beginning. We published the paper in 1984 with a seasonal affective disorder title, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. It's a type of depression, I guess, isn't it? But only occurring at specific times of the year.
It is a type of depression, but I think that one thing people need to realize is that depression is often a late symptom. Often the earlier symptoms are a lack of energy, desire to sleep more, eat more, especially sweets and starches, gain weight, and withdraw. You know, all of a sudden, the things that were stimulating you and you were enjoying in the summertime now no longer seem to be so interesting, and you withdraw, and there can be problems with relationships because one spouse might have it and the other one not have it. And then it can cause friction until you really understand that you're dealing with a condition.
So what would cause, I'm wondering, because there's it seems to be an overlap between seasonal affective disorder and other types of depression. What would cause a doctor to diagnose someone with SAD?
Well, the timing of the depression is key. So if you have it every winter and you're better every summer, that is really the hallmark of classical seasonal affective disorder. If you have it all year round, then probably not. But they can be mixed together. People might suffer from depression most of the year, and then it gets worse in the winter. And so they may have a basic depression overlaid with a seasonal component. So these things are not 100% distinct, but it is good to realize that sometimes you're fine in the summer and you say there's nothing wrong with me, and then the fall and winter comes, you begin to feel the symptoms, and then you say, what the heck is going on here? And so it's good to just understand depression can be during the year, it can be seasonal, and the interesting thing also is that there's now a growing amount of evidence that the lights can even help depression at other times of year as well. But the main data lies with a seasonal affective disorder.
You know, we kind of get a double whammy here in Wisconsin in the fall because
just about the time that the hour, days seem to be getting shorter, then we have to fall back with our time. The switch from daylight savings time to what is considered quote unquote normal time, we lose an hour, and then it's getting darker anyway. It seems to be a kind of a double whammy to me.
Well, I think yes. You know, with the clocks being turned back, you get the extra hour in the morning, but the hour in the afternoon is taken away from you. And most people are up and around in the afternoon and can benefit from that light. But if you sleep halfway through that morning benefit, then you lose that morning light. So, you know, you have to really juggle so that you're sure to get enough light.
I'm wondering, are there some more susceptible than others? I mean, are women more likely than men or vice versa to suffer from it?
Yes, women are more likely than men, especially the women in their reproductive years. It seems that the young girls and the older ladies are not as susceptible as those people in the mid-zone. And part of it is, you know, they're often very stressed with parenting and working, and on top of that, the vulnerability to the low light levels.
Yeah, and I would think if your economic status is not the best, that could also create a problem.
Well, that can create a problem all year round, right?
Yeah, you're right about that. So, but it might exacerbate it a bit when it comes to the fall season. How does where you live impact whether or not you might suffer from SAD?
Well, it's a very important factor, and I'm not unmindful that I'm talking to people in Wisconsin. Yeah. And, of course, you're very far north, and I am sure that your days are shorter, say, than people in Maryland or not to mention Florida. And so, you're more likely to have trouble up where you are than in the middle of the country or in the south. So that's something to be mindful of. You know, sometimes arranging a vacation in the south in the middle of the winter is a good thing to do because, you know, some people have worse times in January or February, and it's nice to get away for about a week. But it's not a substitute for taking care of it all winter long.
Yeah. You know, I was talking with somebody who said that the SAD, seasonal affective disorder, is not supported by objective data, or at least had read something to that effect. How would you respond to that?
Well, needless to say, I have heard that before. Obviously, there are now hundreds of articles on the subject, so I don't know how much support he needs or she, but maybe she or he is one of the undecideds.
Yeah, I'm on your side on this, I think, for sure, and as are millions of other people.
You know, I'll tell you something interesting, but, you know, even with the illness and the light therapy, and there was always some hangout who was a maverick and didn't agree with this and didn't agree with that. And what could I do to persuade this one, and what could I do to persuade that one? And I thought, you know, I will be dead before the last skeptic is convinced.
Oh, man.
I don't really plan to use the rest of my life to persuade that person. They're getting something from their skeptical position, and God bless them. You know?
Dr. Norman Rosenthal, psychiatrist, researcher, and author, his latest book is Defeating SAD, A Guide to Health and Happiness Through All Seasons. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk at WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR.
Coming up on Tuesday's program, we'll be talking about travel with the author of Wisconsin Harbor Towns, The Ultimate Wisconsin Road Trip. And then we'll look at ideas for booking vacations to warm weather destinations with travel agent Kerry Mulliken. And we do that here in Wisconsin on occasion, go to warmer climes, partly, I think, because there's sunlight as well. There's light to help us out and make us feel a little better. And that's what we're talking about today with Dr. Norman Rosenthal, who's really a pioneer in this research, actually came up with the seasonal affective disorder. And his book, his latest book, is Defeating Sad, A Guide to Health and Happiness Through All Seasons. It's great to have him with us, and we'll take some calls. Dan in Manitowoc will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I was wondering if you're getting light therapy, or is it enough to just sit by a window and have the sunshine on you? Is it you need more than that? Does light have to hit your eyes? Or can it hit your skin, or what's the deal with receiving light therapy?
These are great questions, Dan. As you know, if you sit by your window, it depends on what's shining into your window. If it's dazzlingly bright sun, that might be one thing. If the light is coming directly in, whether it's coming down on the roof or from the other side of the house. The trouble with a window is it's very unpredictable. And in the middle of the winter, you're probably not going to get enough light that way. So, I think that it's not as good. We have tested this, and it is an eye-mediated effect. What confuses that a little is that if you're tanning out on a sunny day, which is not SAD at all, there is a mood effect of the UV light, although, of course, there's skin problems and damage that can result from that. So nature has been redundant in giving supplementary pathways that can activate you and give you better mood. But the one that we're talking about here is visual light coming in through the eye. That said, you don't need to stare at it. It's enough that the light kind of shines on your face, because enough light is going to get in that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I wondered if there was a vitamin D effect here, but and then all we'd have to do is drink Wisconsin milk.
Well, that's not really the way that this particular method works. Not that I have anything against milk. I know who I'm talking to up there in Wisconsin. So.
Dan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sammy in Durand called but couldn't stay with us and is wondering if there's an opposite sad when sunny days trigger depression and overcast days do not.
There definitely is an opposite version. You see it in the summertime when people complain either of excessive heat or, surprisingly, too much light. The light affects them, it agitates them, the heat depletes them, and they're in a state of agitated, depleted depression that is not quite as common as the winter type, but it's very disabling and a problem in its own right.
And Carol emailed to ask if a sad light can be used by those with macular degeneration.
Okay, this is a very important question because there is a potential problem there. So I would never suggest that you use a sad light if you have macular degeneration without running it by your eye doctor. It might depend on the individual. It might depend on how much light there is. But the general advice is to avoid bright light. So if you were inclined to do it, please don't do it on your own, but check it out with the ophthalmologist.
Let's go into a little more detail on the light therapy itself that you pioneered. What is it in a way, and how effective can it be? And then we can talk about, how it works and what we need to have.
Well, you can talk about this in different ways. The first is the practical way. Like, you know, you might want to get one of the light boxes that's recommended on Amazon. Some people do very well with the small boxes that are much cheaper, and even take two and use them kind of like stereo speakers on each side. Others prefer a big box. I like a bigger box. It gives me a bigger blast, and I can get away with less of it. It sits on my desktop. It's angled slightly at its down at an angle, and it gives off a really nice light. And I do it pretty much every morning at this time of the year, and it really gets my day going. You know, it's like one of those foundational habits that all of us have. And I really love it. Now, in the middle of the summer, not so much. But I would recommend start with 20 to 30 minutes if you think you might have this, or if you just feel down in the winter, and see what it does for you. The nice thing about these light boxes or fixtures is that most of these companies will take them back within a certain window of time. So be sure to keep the packaging. So in case it doesn't work for you or it bothers you, you can send it back. That said, it's very rarely troublesome to people. It's usually welcomed. But, you know, everybody's different. So just a little word to the wise there.
Yeah. What's the science behind light therapy?
Well, the first science was when we did our very first study where we controlled bright light with a dimmer light, and that proved to be effective. And then we replicated that the next two winters. But what happens in science is it's not good enough to replicate your own work. Other people have to replicate it as well. So it started getting replicated in controlled studies, just like what you do with a drug to establish efficacy. And throughout the United States and Europe, people have found an effect of bright light. Some places some countries don't reimburse for it, but that's as much an economic decision as a scientific one. The data is quite persuasive that the light therapy works. So that was the first wave of studies and research. Subsequent waves have sought to figure out where is it going, as I said, through the eye, not the skin. How is it working? There's some evidence that it may work via serotonin neurons in the brain, just like Prozac or Zoloft. The drugs, the antidepressant drugs, work via serotonin. That seems to be stimulated by light as well. There is a seasonal rhythm in serotonin in the brain. So there are clues, but frankly, nobody's actually pinned down what the genetic problem is. And it does run in families, so there's probably a gene or genes that are responsible for this particular variation.
And as you were talking, I was thinking and wondering about lifestyle factors, you know, exercise or maybe diet to help mitigate symptoms of SAD.
That's a fantastic question because, I mean, I'm a huge exercise fan. It's good for everything, but SAD is one of them. And you can exercise outdoors, you know, bundle yourself up and don't look down at the ground. Look up at the sky where you're going to get a lot of good light. And it's a very powerful combination, some good aerobic exercise plus light or light off snow. If anybody ever gets snow anymore, we don't get much of it down here. I hope you do. But the light off the snow is nice. And so, yeah, exercise plus light, definitely. Don't lie in bed with the covers over your head. That's kind of the worst thing that you can do. Up and about and in front of the light.
And I'm wondering about vacations. I have a friend who will be going on a trip to Disney in Florida with the whole family. Does a, you know, say 9 or 10 days or a week or whatever, breaking up the darkness a bit, does that help?
You know, it's very good, but please remember, if you have SAD in a major way, then and you go down wherever you're going, and you Disney World, you feel wonderful. But then you come back. You're going to stay feeling wonderful for a day or two, but then if you don't get back to your treatment, you can crash. So just be mindful of that, that you haven't been cured. You've just been helped. And that help is not insignificant. I don't want to trivialize it, but it's not definitive.
Yeah. So somebody earlier, one of the callers, mentioned vitamin D. Is there any evidence that vitamin D deficiency contributes to seasonal affective disorder?
There is not. Of course, we all need a certain amount of vitamin D, and it's an issue to be treated in its own right, but it's not the pathway to curing SAD.
That's unfortunate that we there's not a pill for this, in other words.
Well, there are antidepressants. They will help.
Okay.
They will help, but they have side effects that light therapy does not have. And many people end up on both antidepressants and light therapy. I've got a lot of patients who have that combination, and when the light therapy doesn't do the job all by itself, I emphasize that they should not feel like a failure, that, you know, sometimes you need more than one treatment. Sometimes when you've got hypertension, you may need more than one antihypertensive or any kind of condition. So we get away with as little as we can, but we want to get people feeling themselves again.
You should tell us a little about your book, your latest book, Defeating SAD, A Guide to Health and Happiness Through All Seasons. What can we learn there?
Well, what it does, I wanted to condense in one volume everything I have learned that is of practical value to somebody who has this problem or who has a family member or friend with this problem. So there are all kinds of tips that I've picked up over the years, like I say causes of SAD and the winter blues is a three-legged stool. The three legs are your biology, your stress level, and your amount of light. So then I sort of take each one in turn, and, well, your biology you can't help. But, well, you could potentially help, but if it's maybe an estrogen deficiency or whatever, then it's possible. But in the main, the biology is what you're born with. The light you can definitely help, and the stress you can help. So you can do a lot for it. Stress is very important. You know, people who struggle through the winter and they are overloaded, but they can do it all in the summer, maybe get a little bit of help. Or maybe bring the other family members into a discussion of how the winter's a difficult time for you, and they chip in a little more, and you'll help them out in the summer. Anything like that. It's the whole point is, if you understand what's going on, you know how to reverse it. So I'm just looking down through the index here. Cognitive behavior therapy has been very powerful in SAD. And it's definitely something to think about. They talk about an ABC effect. There's the A is something happens, the B is the belief, and the C is the consequence. So let's say you're depressed. You call up a friend. You want to come walk with me. The friend says, no, thanks. And then you think, well, maybe she doesn't want to walk with me. Maybe she doesn't really like me anymore. You know, a depressed person is easily swayed to think the worst. And then the cognitive therapy would say, wait a sec, let's think of all the reasons why she may not want to walk with you. She may not be feeling well. She may be busy. She may have other plans, whatever, you know, but you're jumping to the worst possibility. So it works with your thinking. It works with your behavior. And it's actually been shown, there's a researcher, Kelly Rohan, she's up in Vermont, and she's shown that this cognitive behavior therapy is very potent. So I think when you combine these things together, that's what I say in my book. The most important word in the book is combine. Don't look for just one magic cure. It's often a matter of putting together different things that each contribute in their own way so that winter feels wonderful. And that sounds strange for someone with SAD, but that's how it feels these days to me, and I've got SAD as much as any of my patients.
Dr. Norman Rosenthal, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it, and looking forward to reading your book, Defeating SAD, A Guide to Health and Happiness Through All Seasons. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for your time. Have a good winter.
You as well. Hope we can do that again with him. And thank you for listening, and thanks to Clara Neipert and Joel Padnott, our producers, and to Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, and, of course, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store through the afternoon.